whenever I've kind of just taken that risk and leapt and had the confidence to expose myself in some way, that's usually when I've had the most success. And sometimes, you know, you can do that and you can have a great audition or you could have a great experience and still not get the gig. But when I'm at my best is when I say, okay, this is, you know, this is my interpretation of it. This is what I'm going to do with the role. And if you hate that, I can't control that. Or if it's not right for the role, I can't control that. But I can control being, you know, being loose and letting it fly.
That's actor Matthew Del Negro in the latest episode of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back, one and all, to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. If you're new here, All Things Risk is an exploration of life through the lenses of risk and uncertainty. We have enjoyable conversations with some pretty incredible guests. And the aim of all of this is to learn how to take intelligent risks, how to be better decision makers, how to become more resilient, and how to understand the world around us just that little bit more. Thank you for tuning in once again. Thank you all for sharing the show. All of you have done that, have provided me with feedback. I hope all of you are well, however and wherever you are listening. Let's get into it, because I think that you are all going to love this episode. And to start things off, I want to offer that we often think of outcomes of things that we want as binary. In other words, they either happen or they don't. And imagine something that you want. It could be a career goal, a relationship goal, a personal aspiration, and that at some point in the future, you will learn whether or not you get that thing. And imagine you get to that future point and the outcome is a no. Now, imagine that you can do something about that, but it requires you to do a kind of a weird and grueling marathon. You get to run to the next kilometer or mile marker, and at that point, you'll find out once again whether or not that thing is a yes or a no, and that odds are it will be a no. It might be 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1, but if you keep running and you keep crossing those kilometer markers, at some point, there will be a yes in there. So, what's your strategy? How are you going to maximize the number of kilometer markers that you get to reach? This, ladies and gentlemen, is in many ways the story of my guest, Matthew Del Negro. Matthew is a TV and film actor. He's based in Los Angeles. And if you read through Matt's TV credits, it sounds like a list of some of the most incredible and popular shows in the history of American television. Shows like The Sopranos, Law and Order, The West Wing, CSI Miami, Criminal Minds, and most recently, the series Goliath, the second season of which has recently premiered on Amazon Prime. Amazing, right? And when you think of that list of credits, you might think that Matthew knew that at some point that yes was coming, that he knew when it was coming, and that it was in some ways sort of preordained. But as you'll hear, that's not how it went down at all. Matthew had to go through many no's, perhaps 10,000 no's, as goes the title of his own podcast. So this is a conversation about perseverance and resilience. It's about not just knowing what you want and having passion and self-belief, all of which are important, but it's also about practical strategies and tactics necessary to achieve things in the face of what might seem like long odds. So I think that you're going to get a lot out of this. Let's dive in. Here's Matthew Del Negro.
I'm good to go.
Excellent. So Matt, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast.
Thank you, Ben. Yeah, great to be here.
This is going to be fun. you are an actor, and I have to profess that I'm not a big television viewer, right? So I don't watch a lot of television, and then a lot of the shows that we have over here in the UK are a little bit different on normal TV. But when I look at your CV and the shows that you've been on, you know, I look at it and wow, what an amazing CV. And so I have loads of questions around how you got to doing what you do. But maybe we can start with how you got into the world of acting. Is that something that you always wanted to do?
No. Well, first of all, thank you for saying that about my work. You know, it's nice to be reminded of it, because it does, you know, you can forget what you've done and it doesn't always feel that way. So that's really kind of you. No, I did not. I mean, as I was preparing to sit down with you and looking at what you do with this podcast, which I love, by the way, All About Risk, I thought, for your listeners, so I was thinking like, oh my God, if there was anybody that was not qualified to do something, it was me. I was really very late to the game, and it was kind of end of college is when I really kind of got the call to become an actor. And prior to that, I was an athlete growing up, and I played all sports and loved it, was really kind of obsessed, but never considered myself really a great athlete. I always felt like I was a grinder. I was hardworking. I was passionate about it. And that made up, you know, my hustle kind of, I felt like made up for any lack of ability. It wasn't like I was terrible, but I wasn't a standout like some other guys that I grew up with. And I was fortunate enough to have gone to Boston College, and I played Division I lacrosse there. And it was junior year. Well, actually, it was between sophomore and junior year. I wanted to study abroad, and most people go the spring of junior year, they'll go abroad. And I, you know, a couple of upperclassmen had gone to Australia. I thought that sounded really interesting, but it was going to coincide with the spring season of lacrosse. So I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go away between sophomore and junior year. And so I went to Italy, and long story short, I was going out with a girl from my college who was in Florence. It was a couple hours away. We broke up on that trip. My sister had given me a journal. You look back at those first entries and they were very generic entries, you know, today I went to the piazza, that kind of thing. And then when this breakup happened, I think I just kind of like poured everything out into the journal.
Right.
And it was just a matter of being outside of my element, at school in Boston, and, you know, everything that we can kind of get wrapped up in our own lives and our identity through the roles that we're playing. And I kind of was outside of it and really examined what I was doing. And I in that journal are the first seeds of me saying, oh, maybe I should be a writer. Maybe I should be an actor. Maybe I should, you know, mm-hmm. It was like all very, very new to me, and scary, because I certainly did not have the qualifications.
What did you study in college?
I was an English major. So, mm-hmm. You know, I look back in retrospect, it's not quite as nuts as it felt at the time or as it seemed to others at the time. Now, you know, with hindsight, I was an English major. I always kind of thought I would end up being a lawyer because my dad's a lawyer. My mom is a retired special ed teacher. And, you know, the way they were both, you know, they are natural teachers, I think. And my dad, even as a lawyer, he's kind of the opposite of the, you know, the shark lawyer, the jokes you hear. He's more of like a teacher or a social worker at heart, I think. So the way he spoke about the law really kind of excited me. And but as I got older and, you know, kind of I realized, oh, I don't know if I want to be a lawyer. Maybe I'll play one on TV, which is what I've since done.
Yeah.
But really, his the way I look at acting really relates to the way he described the law, which was, you know, you're getting behind your client's point of view and you're defending them within the letter of the law. And as an actor, I feel like I'm getting behind, I'm getting under the skin of my character and I'm defending their point of view to the world without judgment. You know, I have to get in there and I have to defend this person. And so it's not that different. And I was an English major, ended up getting, well, prior to that. So I have this whole kind of what I call, you know, kind of a quarter life crisis in Italy. I you know, burned through like 2 journals, I think. I go back home. I'm kind of like on fire. Like I got this new voice within me. And I go back to school and I just went right back to playing lacrosse. So I played fall ball. It was like the pressure of the just the tried and true beaten path that you've been on. I went right back to it. And I was playing fall ball and it was the end of that season. And we were practicing and I remember running around the field during practice and I had this thought, like, I wish I'd just roll my ankle right now. Huh. And I thought, this is crazy. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're, when you're wishing that you're hurt to get out of something, that's not a good sign that you're doing what you should be doing. And I went to the coach and I just said, hey, I think I'm done, which was really tough to do because I have so many things in my mind of like that is being a quitter. On the other hand, you know, you have to stop one thing and give up one thing in order to jump into something else. So he said, think about it. You still got a slot on the team come springtime. And I said, I've thought about it and I'm done. And I wanted to go on spring break and I wanted to do other college experiences. And I ended up like about a month later, my roommate as well, which is funny, he had never acted before. We both went out for a play and he ended up getting a lead in this play and I got nothing. And then a month after that, I went in for another audition at the school and I got the lead of this tiny one act called Hello Out There by William Saroyan. And it was, you know, not sexy at all. It wasn't even on a stage. It was in a lecture hall at Boston College. Mm-hmm. But I did it and I absolutely loved it. I mean, I was like, wow, this kind of covers everything I've been looking for. It's physical, it's analytical, it's psychological, it's, you know, it just involves every sense. And it really just, you know, when they say you catch the bug or, you know, you hear the call, it's like, that's what happened with me. I did that one little thing and I just told people I'm going to be an actor. I mean, it was, people were like, what are you talking about? And, you know, I don't know if it's known in the UK, but you know, you're playing lacrosse in college, that and the theater could not be further from each other.
Right.
And
what I was going to say, just ask you about, I mean, what I understand about Division I athletics in the United States is that it's a full on commitment, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you're in the weight room, you're at practice. Like I said, there's fall ball in the off season. So you're still playing and we had a lot of fun, but it's, you know, spring break and what we weren't going on spring break to the Bahamas. We were going, you know, we were playing, we were practicing, doing, you know, double sessions and all that. So it is a different experience and it's an incredible experience. And I'm very fortunate to have done it. I think what happened with me was it kind of ran its course, you know, and I just wanted to try something else. And it was just very, at the time, it seemed like I was just like shattering my entire world to do this. Mm-hmm. But like most things, you know, your fear of it is worse than the actual thing itself. And then when you do make a decision and you take a leap, what you find is a shocking support system where people are like, oh, that's cool, man. That's cool. You're going to be an actor. You know, like, I mean, there's both. I mean, you get you get made fun of a little bit, and you also kind of get this like, oh, good for you, you know, you're like, you're taking a leap. So it was really interesting.
Yeah. It's funny how things sometimes kind of line up. And the comment you made about rolling your ankle is an interesting one, because I've heard that from other athletes, and sometimes there are athletes who are really prone to lots of injuries, and sometimes you wonder if there's something else going on in terms of the, you know, the person's motivations. I'm not, you know, saying that, you know, attributing injuries to, you know, not wanting it, but, you know, sometimes the body reacts in a way that corresponds with, you know, how your mind or how your soul is feeling. And see that. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I just read something. There's a book a friend of mine recommended called The Big Leap. And it was about how we have these, we all kind of have a thermostat, and it's set to this, you know, it's going to be between 65 and 70 or whatever it is. And if we go too high, you know, we go too hot, we do things to bring ourselves back to that range where we are kind of preset. And if we go too low, we bring it up. And the idea being like, you know, something, a huge success comes into your life, but if your mindset is not there to support it, you can sometimes sabotage yourself subconsciously with that, you know, you don't even realize it, you know. And I think sometimes an injury or sickness or just sometimes almost creating overwhelm, it keeps you in that comfortable place that you know and you've known for so long, because sometimes it's easier to just, you know, be where you've been than it is to go into new territory. That's kind of the leap.
Sure. And I was thinking about that when you were talking about coming back for that senior year, because we all have this sort of internal programming. They're kind of like grooves in our, you know, in our behaviors, that it's so easy to slip back into it and life goes on and it's a comfortable place. So very interesting that you're able to recognize that at a relatively young age.
Yeah. You know what it was? I don't know that. It's funny. I don't give myself credit for recognizing it. Mm-hmm. It was like the universe grabbed me by the lapel and was like, this is what you're doing. I mean, it felt unavoidable. I mean, it was kind of like, I just couldn't, I don't know. I can't describe it except to say that once, you know, it's like once that voice comes up from deep within and tells you like, hey, this is what you should be doing. It's hard to stuff it away.
Right.
It really is. You know?
Can we talk about what you did with that and the early days? Because if you look at the world of acting, and this being a show about risk, I'm a risk guy, and you think about the probability, you know, what are the chances of making it, so-called making it, they're pretty low as far as I gather. And if you have a grandiose plan of, you know, by the age of 30, you're going to be a star. I'm very keen to get your perspective on this. Perhaps that's not the best way to go, versus taking, you know, opportunity, then the next opportunity, then the next one. So I'm kind of curious, did you have a grandiose plan or did you just kind of go with it?
I had kind of both. I mean, I think I had a plan. I think once I decided this is what I was going to do, which was pretty immediate, I just said, I'm going to do this. And I had no clue what that meant. I had no, I just had no roadmap at the time. But I knew, I was just like, this is what I'm going to do. And when I graduated college, you know, at first it's kind of, oh, that's cool, you know, and like you graduate college and you go home. And basically I thought, okay, I am going to, you know, you got to be sensible about it in some way. And you also have to be, you really have to be like delusional, or what I call like will, you have to have willful denial. You know, it's like you can't really, if you look at those statistics, you're just going to bury yourself.
Right.
I mean, if you, you know, those statistics, they exist. But if you look at yourself like a number, I don't know how inspiring that's going to be. And if you're not inspired, you're not going to be able to get yourself to the point where you can actually take that leap. I mean, if you think of, you know, think about jumping off of a cliff, like, you've got to fire yourself up to just run and you know, let out like some kind of a scream or a war cry and just jump off the cliff. And so there is that. And at the same time, I feel like I had a pretty pragmatic kind of blue collar approach, which was, I moved home. I, you know, literally like lived at home that summer. I worked with a mason in my town laying patios. I made money. I ended up auditioning for a community theater in Connecticut, like the next town over, and it was a musical. And I wasn't, I mean, that whole story is actually kind of funny, but you know, we don't have to tell it, but if you want to hear
well,
it.
Well, no, let's hear it. It sounds good.
All right. Yeah. I knew nothing, man. When I tell you, I knew nothing. Like, I looked in the paper and it said, you know, there's this musical, The Mystery of Edwin Drood at Wilton Play Shop. And I was like, all right. And it says, you know, prepare 4 bars of music and, you know, for the accompany, you know, the pianist. And I thought, huh, okay. So I did actually play a little piano and I could sing a little bit. I could carry a tune and a little guitar and I could carry a tune, but I'm not like a musical theater guy. So I called them and I said, hey, can I just come in and like sing a cappella like Billy Joel? And they're like, whatever you want to do, you know? So I go there and it was like something out of a TV show. It's not, I've never experienced this ever since this experience, but what they did was everybody that was auditioning was in the theater. So you would audition in front of the other people you were going against. And I've never seen this since, but there was a pianist up near the stage, and then people would get up, they'd hand their sheet music over, and they'd get up and they'd sing. And I'm telling you, the first 4 people to get up, some of them were a little younger than me, some were a little older, but they got up and they had these, you know, beautiful, ridiculous musical theater voices, trained voices. And I get up, you know, they call my name. I'm like, you know, maybe number 5. And I'm wearing like, you know, jeans and a white t-shirt and Chuck Taylor's, like, you know, Converse. Like, I look like Joe College, you know. And I get up and they say, where's your sheet music? And I said, yeah, I'm just going to sing a cappella. So they're like, okay. And I just started snapping my fingers and started going, whoa, the longest for the longest time. And I just started singing Billy Joel and kind of dancing around the, that was terrible, by the way. And what happened was I ended up getting cast for this role that was the chairman, who was, there was a play within the play. And I think they wanted someone who was just confident enough to be up on stage. And I had to improv with people that were coming into the audience every night before with a British accent, you know, before the play even started. And then we go into the play and I'm kind of narrating it and also jumping into roles, and I had songs and everything. And it was one of those examples where, you know, I was so dumb and naive that I was able to just bet on myself and say, this is what I'm going to do. I can't compete with you guys in that field of what everybody else is doing, but I'm going to give you my, you know, what my specialty is, and this is it. And it worked. And I found throughout the years, whenever I've had, now look, that was a community theater. It's not like it was, you know, Broadway. But what I've found is whenever I've kind of just taken that risk and leapt and had the confidence to expose myself in some way, that's usually when I've had the most success. And sometimes, you know, you can do that and you can have a great audition or you could have a great experience and still not get the gig. But when I'm at my best is when I say, okay, you know, this is my interpretation of it. This is what I'm going to do with the role. And if you hate that, I can't control that. Or if it's not right for the role, I can't control that. But I can control being, you know, being loose and letting it fly.
That's awesome.
So that, anyway, that's a little, you know, tangent story.
But, no, I really like that, because I would have also thought that a lot of those other people auditioning, they would have a whole bunch of expectations going into this, right? I've got all this training and I should get this and that. And, you know, whereas all you could do is just focus on what you can do and not worry about the outcome. And that will kind of take care of itself. And that's a great way to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess in a way that's kind of, you know, and a longer shot of the whole thing, what I did with my career, which was I just focused on what I could do. I went, so I did that over the summer. I did that at the end of the summer. Then I met someone through the play who got me a job. I was waiting tables in Connecticut that fall. I was taking the train down to New York City two nights a week for a class. I saved up enough money that by January 1st of 1995, I moved into the city. And even, you know, this is something that I think would be good for your listeners to hear, and I'm sure they've heard it in other ways through other guests, but people think about the glamour of being an actor. Mm. And that's just, in my experience, it couldn't be further from the truth. And one of the things that I did that was probably you know, a big reason that I was able to sustain this dream. You know, it's like you could have passion. Passion is necessary, but passion on its own is not going to cut the mustard, because you got to, you know, you got to turn the lights on. You got to, you know, put food on your table. And if you don't have a trust fund, it's like, how are you going to do that? Mm-hmm. So I scoured New York City and the boroughs, and I found this rent stabilized apartment on the Upper East Side. And it was like $1,000 a month. I got a roommate. I was a buddy from college. We built a wall. We both built lofts for our beds and put desks underneath them. It was a railroad apartment. It was not sexy at all. And it was rent stabilized though. So I was paying $500 a month that first year to live in the city. And I stayed there for 7 years. And my seventh year, it was like $632 a month, you know, to be in New York City. So that allowed me to, you know, I was bartending at the time. I was studying at the time. You know, you'd meet with scene partners. It was, I would basically agent myself, because I didn't have an agent. So I'd scour through backstage and look for opportunities and send out headshots and resumes and cover letters. And when you would get a job, which a lot of the time was like free black box theater, you would have to, you know, not work your bartending gig. So for a few weeks or over a month, you would not have an income. So how can you do that if you have a monthly nut that's too high? You're not going to be able to do that. So you kind of have to be smart about your finances and save up your money so that you can go do this. Because if you don't go do that, you're not going to get better, or you're not going to get the exposure. And you know, so it's very, very, very difficult. And what I have found with my own podcast, 10,000 No's, is that I'm interviewing, you know, entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and other people that you think like, oh, well, they had it made, you know, they're in finance, you know, they're in finance. If they're a venture capitalist, it must've been gravy the whole time. And you're like, no. You go scratch the surface with those stories, and it's the same deal. Like nothing is easy. Those jobs that look, you know, really glamorous, if they were easy, everybody would be doing them. You know, so you almost have to live like three lives in one. It's not easy, but if you love it, you kind of figure out a way to get through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would have still thought throughout that 7 year period, and along the way, you can talk about whether or not there was a memorable moment in which you got, you know, the quote unquote big break, or other signals that, yeah, I'm on the right path. Was that the case?
Yeah. Because there were times, you know, it's largely a mind game, because it's like, what's the story that you're telling yourself about how it's going? And it's hard to tell the story that, like, it's going great, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, when there are no external factors that are backing up your, you know, your large opinion of, like, how great it's going. So there were moments, I mean, there were really, you know, dark and scary moments. And then there were also moments where, you know, it was a long time into it. But one of the things that I got, which was really kind of a lucky break, I had gone in for something that I found through Backstage that was originally a non-union feature film. I went in, I hit it off with the filmmakers. They were from Boston. It was called The North End. It was shooting in Boston. I ended up getting the part, and it was a lead role. And then the director had a contact. He had PA'd on Casino, and he got the script to Frank Vincent. And Frank Vincent had done Raging Bull and Goodfellas. And, you know, for those of you that don't know the name Frank Vincent, he's the one that says in Goodfellas, you know, now get your fucking shine box. That guy, Billy Batts. So anyway, he came on to the movie, and it became union. And then he got some friends of his to join it, and it became kind of bigger than it originally was. And it was a great experience. I got a friend of mine, the part of my roommate, because he had gone in and they weren't sure. And I was like, you know, you should cast him because we already have a history. So we went up and had a ball. It ended up going to Montreal Film Festival, Boston Film Festival. It got, you know, right up in Variety. And it didn't really, it wasn't a huge experience in terms of, like, the business, but for me, it really was at the time. And we, you know, it was like in our own little microcosm, we were signing autographs at these film festivals. Right. And it was like, we just had this experience of, like, oh, this is kind of nice to be treated well and, you know, not be taking someone's drink order for the weekend.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, so that helped. And, like, I got commercials at a certain point, and that really helped. And that was also a little bit of money. And I just kind of, I would just take that money from the commercials and pretend it didn't exist. I'd put it away and I would bartend and make my money bartending. But those things, they all helped get to the point where you could really answer someone with a straight face and when they asked you what you did and say, I'm an actor. Because it took years to say that, Ben. It was like, you know, people would say, what do you do? Well, I'm waiting tables and I'm trying to be an actor. And then it would be like, what are you doing? Well, I'm an aspiring actor, but I'm bartending at such and such. And then it would be like, well, I do this, I act, but I also, you know, and then finally it was like years into it. It's like, I'm an actor. That's what I do. That's it, you know? But that was a big break. And then the bigger break that really helped was The Sopranos. That was, you know, that put me from being kind of really anonymous to all of a sudden I had a chunk of work to do on the fourth season of Sopranos. I played cousin Brian Camerata. I was Edie Falco's cousin, you know, Carmela's cousin, and Tony took me under his wing. I was his financial advisor. And that was just a huge show. I mean, I still think considered one of the greatest shows in TV history.
Yeah,
man. I mean, that was definitely a game changer to work with, you know, people that talented, to work on a show that everybody was watching. All of a sudden you're riding the subway and people are saying things. It was, you know, surreal.
But you couldn't have known at that time how big the show was going to be, could you?
Well, yes, it was already. I didn't come on until the fourth season, so it was huge. So when I went in for it, it was a big deal. When the closer I got, and when they told me I was their front runner, and I had to go back in for a final like fourth or fifth callback, I had already been in for the producers. I had to go back in, and they wanted David Chase in the room, and they wanted to see a couple of other guys. Then I thought, like, you know, I got so close that I thought, oh, come on, you know, I'm going to get this close and they're going to, And they're going to bring in some big gun to do it. Like, is this really going to happen? I'm going to be on The Sopranos, you know, because at the time you just could, you know, you'd visualize it. But you really, it was so hard. And to think of a show that big, it seemed impossible, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of great lessons in everything that you talked about. I think we could go deep on quite a few things there. But I really like the what you were talking about in terms of, you know, it took you years, right? And so I guess what I wanted to talk a little bit about is just going back to that whole mindset and this concept of perseverance in the face of long odds, and, you know, linking back to your show, 10,000 no's. And I think sometimes we quit too early when we want something. And if you go back and think about the progress, you know, if you just set the bar at, by the age of 30, I want to be a big star, or you know, whatever it was, you might have missed the incremental steps that you were making. Maybe it meant getting better as an actor, getting closer to big parts, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, interesting you bring that up, because about 9 months before that Sopranos experience, I had gone in for a soap opera, and it was not my dream job, but I was bartending, and the thought of getting paid and having a contract, you know, making money, I was like, great, this will be a great training ground, you know. And so I went in, I got called back again. It seemed like I don't know if this is correct, but it felt like maybe 7 auditions, like 7 rounds of it, before I was on their set in Brooklyn for a screen test. And it was me and 2 other guys. And it was, you know, it's high pressure. You want the job at that point. You've been thinking about it for a few weeks now. And the closer it gets, the more obsessed you get. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I kept myself together, and I felt really good about what I did there. And I left there, and I called my agent, and I said, it went really well. I think I'm going to get this thing. And, you know, and usually it's, you know, it's tough to say that, but I was like, I think I'm going to get it. So I wait a day, I wait another day, and he calls me. It's like, it's not going further. And it's so defeating, because you're just completely back out on the street with nothing to show for that whole, you know, all of those rounds of callbacks and a screen test. It's like, oh, good for you. But it's like there's no consolation prize. You just have to go audition again. And there really was a feeling at that point, like it was such a kick in the gut. It's like, man, I'm just back to square one. But you kind of pick yourself up, you get back in the game, you study, you get inspired, and you keep going. And it's like, had I just folded after that experience with the soap opera, I would never have been in the position 9 months later to get The Sopranos. And I look at it, when I got The Sopranos, I thought, thank God I got The Sopranos, because that was such a prestigious job and such an incredibly talented group of people to work around, that it just put me in a different light. And I never ever could have seen that on the day that my agent called to tell me I wasn't getting soap opera. You know, it just you couldn't see it from that vantage point. How could you know? So wherever people are right now, you think, you don't know what's around the corner. It might be tomorrow. It might be 6 months. It might be a year. And I think the job is just keep yourself above water and keep getting better and keep being inspired and give yourself opportunities. And, you know, then you can eventually strike, because eventually, hopefully what you're selling and what they're buying matches up and you get something.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. That's really, really cool. Did you get 10,000 no's? How many no's do you go through before you get a role like The Sopranos?
I've never kept track, but I've been doing this a long time, and there are tons and tons and tons and tons of auditions and opportunities, and it's so many and it's so often that there are times when, you know, I mean, there are times now when I'll get an email from my manager saying, oh, such and such didn't go any further. And I'm like, wait, which one? What was that one? You know, where you really, you don't even remember what the project was, and you were so geared up to go in for it, but you kind of develop this, I've tried to develop this thick skin where I'm excited enough to go in with excitement and really be prepared and really want it, but then try to just drop it and forget about it, which is really difficult to do if you really want the gig. But try to just, once you've done what you could do, let it go and, you know, trust that the universe is going to give you the gigs you're supposed to get and not going to give you the ones that you don't. And that sounds very, you know, I'm sure there are people listening going like, oh, come on, man, you know, but it, you know, it is true. You can control what you can control. And then there's a lot of stuff that is outside of your control. And particularly as an actor, it's, you know, your appearance can knock you out, your age, your height, your weight, your skin tone, anything. You know, there are so many, you know, it went really well, but they cast a bigger star in a role that you're playing her son, and you know, she's younger than they originally anticipated, so you're out now,
right?
You know, that it's just like, that doesn't mean that you did what you did in the room, but when they're putting together a whole show, they have a bigger picture in mind, and so you can't take that personally. And I think what happens with people that are newer to this is they take it so personally that they don't, it's almost like their expectations are, I wouldn't say lower your expectations, because that sounds like I'm saying, you know, don't reach for the stars, but I'm saying lower, know what the game is. You know, if you're a major league baseball player and you think that you're going to get a hit every time you're up to bat, you know,
I got news for you.
You're not going to do that. That's just not going to happen. Statistically, that's not the deal. So it wouldn't make sense to, like, you know, completely fall apart if you struck out once, or if you, you know, fly out to center field. Like, this doesn't, that's not smart. You're not, it's not sustainable, that
right.
mindset.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even if you were to look at that time when you auditioned for that soap opera, as an outsider, I would have looked at that and said, oh my God, that's amazing that you almost, you know, got that role. So you're really close, man. That's what I probably would have told you at the time, but it's hard when you're going through it. Right. But if you talk about the universe kind of conspiring to help you out, which is, you know, a great way to look at it, for those who might have a little bit of a problem with trying to view it in those terms, you can, I guess, view the progress that you made just getting that close. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing, is just like how you frame it and how you frame it to yourself. And sometimes what happens there is like the initial impact of that rejection can throw you off for a little bit. And that's fine. You know, you're allowed to go like lick your wounds for a day or two. But if you find yourself, you know, in your cave for too long, it's probably a good idea to, like, you know, pick yourself up and dust yourself off and go out into the sunlight and go, okay, it's not, you know, there's still some blue sky out there. It's, you know, it's not the end of the world. This is a role, you know. It's like, it could be, you know, I mean, even as I was kind of looking at some of the material you had sent me for your podcast, and you're hearing these stories of people who have had harrowing events happen to them. And I've interviewed people like that as well. You're like, okay, let's put it in perspective. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it ain't that bad. It ain't that bad. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, you might, the timing might not have aligned with where you wanted to be earlier on, or maybe it did, but, you know, to say, oh, you know, you almost got a role on a major soap opera. Well, pretty damn good. I did want to talk a little bit about your podcast and this whole concept of 10,000 no's and why you decided to do it. Because I mean, I love that. And so what you were talking about, it just transcends so many other domains. So I think it's awesome that you've pulled this podcast together and you're having these kinds of conversations, because a lot of people need to hear this sort of stuff.
Well, thank you, and right back at you, because I think what you and I are doing is similar in spirit. And really, it's it's really an extension of me. If you listen to 10,000 No's, you'll kind of get to know me, because it's and as you could tell, you had said to me, I said, what do you want to talk about? You kind of told me what you're interested in, and I said, oh, cool, just ask me questions. This is just my life. Like, what's happened is everything is kind of lined up where my career is the podcast. The podcast is the career. I've been asked to now go do some speeches on perseverance and resilience, and that's all. It's all the same thing. I mean, it's because of what I do, I've all of a sudden, I guess where it came from was that all of that, the rejection, which can be so disheartening. I felt like I was, when people would ask, you know, in this day and age and social media and all of that stuff, I think the instinct is to be like, no, it's great. It's great. Everything's great. And I think what I did with 10,000 No's, I was like, okay, yeah, it is good. I am really fortunate. But there's also all of this. And there are other people out there that must be dealing with their own set of 10,000 No's, and they're getting discouraged. And I realized, like, I've been through the fire. I'm still standing. So, one, what about other people that are in other fields? And a lot of them also, because of who I'm in touch with, a lot of them are in my industry. You know, there are writers, producers, showrunners, actors, all of that. But I'm also interested. I've had mountain climbers and Ironman world champions and you know, writers and cancer survivors and all of it, holistic healers. And I thought, okay, if people look at what I do and they think it's glamorous, and I know there's a larger story underneath, then these people must have a larger story underneath. And what I've found is, if you scratch the surface of anybody, they've got 10,000 no's. And so it's really my attempt to, one, to kind of like find interesting people that would be cool to hear a conversation with. So that people are, you know, you're driving in your car or wherever you're going, you're like, oh, this is cool. I want to hear about this person. But also for anybody who's thinking of taking a leap, or they've already taken the leap, and everybody in their community is like, oh, you're doing it. But they're kind of like, I'm doing it, but it's taking its toll on me, and I don't know if I can make it. This podcast is basically to go, you're not alone. I've been there. All these other people have been there. Hear their stories. Listen to where they were. I mean, they were in some dark places, and they made it out. And you're listening to them on the, you know, on the subway or whatever, you know, so you can do that too. And that's all it is. It's pretty simple concept of just trying to provide something to the world that is going to help connect people and inspire people and lift them up. Because I feel like there's a lot of, there's a lot of negativity out there too. And it's like, why not contribute something that's going to, you know, kind of examine how tough things can be, but also give a little bit of a lift, you know what I mean? And just go. So that's what it is. I've been having so much fun. I mean, it's completely a labor of love, and it's been really, I have learned so much and been inspired and been changed by these conversations. Honestly, like it's kind of nuts.
Podcasting so awesome in that way? You can have a great conversation with someone, and you know, send it out into the world, and you change as a result of the conversations that you have.
Yeah. And it's also kind of an excuse to, like, I just called director I worked with yesterday. I had done this Reese Witherspoon, Sofia Vergara film a couple of years ago. And and Ann Fletcher, the director, and I called her, and she's like, "What's up?" And I was like, "Hey, do you want, you know, I don't even know if you're aware, I have this podcast, blah, blah, blah. I'd love to have you on." And she was like, "That's so cool." She's like, "Yeah, well, it'll be an excuse to hang out and like really have a real conversation." Because I don't think, it's funny, for me at least, I've got kids and I've got a career. So it's like, you know, you're running around. It's hard to justify sometimes, like, "Oh, let's go grab some drinks and talk," you know. But with this, it's like, "Hey, let's get together, hang out, have a cool conversation that has some purpose and that hopefully, you know, other people can hear." And whether you know, I always think each one of these conversations has a bunch of takeaways, but some of them are going to apply to, you know, different listeners than others. You know, I have one coming up this week that it's particularly great for people who are in my industry, because it's the guy that is the showrunner on Goliath, the show that I'm about to come out with the second season and all that. And it's great, like, if you're an actor or you're in my industry, but it's also cool for people outside of it, you know. But you, so you can kind of receive them on an entertainment level, and then also on kind of like a self-help type of level. And it's been fun, and I'm still tweaking it as I go. Picking up, you know, this is another area. You talk about taking risk. Like, did I know what I was doing when I started a podcast? No, hell no. Yeah. I mean, I was an idiot, you know, but
been there, done that as well.
Yeah. But you learn again, you do something, you take a risk, you know, and people come out of the woodwork to help you. It's amazing to me. It's kind of like, if you build it, he will come, you know, the Field of Dreams quote. It's like, if you commit to something, that's what I've found. It's like, if you commit to something, people are kind of looking for a cause to get behind.
Yep.
I really think it. I mean, and I forget that from time to time, but every time I kind of like, you know, plant myself and say, "I'm doing this and I don't give a shit what you think about it. This is what I'm doing." All of a sudden, people, like, you have that conviction and people go,
they rally around it. Yeah.
What's he doing? Oh, that's cool. And it takes a while. I mean, I sometimes
talk to me about it. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's not overnight.
No, it takes a huge amount of time, but it's, you know, I think it's what you're doing is a similar process to where and how you started as an actor. And it, you know, you can't say when, but you know, it works. You can't say when or how, but it works if you continue with it, which, you know, I love that about how you've gone about that. I did want to talk about this whole concept of success, however, in your industry, or maybe you've got some thoughts now more broadly, but what does that, you know, what is it? What does it look like?
What does success look like? That's a great question. I think there are, you know, there are different kinds of success. You know, there's financial success, there's artistic success, there's, you know, are you satisfied? But I think ultimately it's like, can you live a life where you can support yourself and your family, and you're doing something that you feel is contributing to the world, and having like some kind of a good impact, and still and be able to do that and enjoy your time here, you know. Can you help? I mean, I feel like it ends up being about serving others in some way, you know, whether it's as an actor and you're, you know, I mean, when you're an actor, I know it's not like you're curing cancer. But hopefully some of your work, maybe not all of it, but even if you're doing a comedy and you're making someone laugh, I mean, that's, you know, that's valuable. Or if you're, you know, I had this thing, I know you said you don't watch TV, but there's a show called Scandal, and I played a character that was like very, very different from me, but very, it had a real impact. People really watched the show, and this guy was a gay male prostitute who ends up getting married to the chief of staff in the White House, and there was a wedding, and there was and this guy that they started off, he was getting his MBA, he was in DC. They started him off like he had everything together, and then they exposed him to be somebody who had who had a really tough upbringing and was disowned by his parents, and I there was like a flood of response on social media from the LGBT community saying like, thank you for telling our story. And I was like, that's pretty cool that, you know, that a whole community of people are saying, and that's really more Shonda Rhimes, it's her show, it's her writing, but that I was a part of that is kind of cool that it can bring people together. And so whether it's that or a podcast, if you're somehow helping to maybe make the world like leave it just a little bit better than you left it, you know, or than you found it.
Sure. And are you at a point where you think you can kind of choose some of the roles that you know, either that you go for or that you know, that you get? And if so, you know, how do you choose
a little
those?
Bit, you know, a little bit. I mean, I turn things down. I'll turn auditions down. I'll, but not to the point where, not to the point certainly where I hope I will be. And to that end, I'm writing now, and I'm feeling like I want to give myself the opportunity to play something that is not being given to me. And so, you know, that's a whole other beast, which is, getting that off the ground. But no, so I would say, I mean, I'm in the best position I've been in. And yet I'm not quite where I hope that I can be, you know? And so there's a certain amount of, there's always kind of, I don't know. I feel like most of the actors I know, most of the artists I know there and the entrepreneurs I know, there's always like this thirst for learning more, being better, and yet tempering that with being really grateful for what I have had and where I am, you know, because it could be a lot worse. And I'm one of the lucky ones. And yet I still feel like I haven't scratched the surface of what I would like to do. And who knows, man? I mean, I don't know. I heard a quote, my buddy sent me a quote from, I think it was Dennis Hopper the other day. And I mean, this guy's had an amazing career, and he's like, yeah, I feel like I never did anything. And I had not, you know, I never had got the roles I wanted. And I was like, oh man, that's Dennis Hopper. That's killing me. But there is a certain amount of that actually I think is the fuel that is necessary to kind of keep digging and to keep that beginner's mind and never feel like, you know, I mean, never feel like you've learned all that you can learn, so that you'll be digging till the day you die, hopefully, so that you're always a student and you're always kind of like trying to progress and yet also being grateful for everything. You know, it's a pretty cool life.
Yeah, there's that wonderful quote by Pablo Casals, the cellist, who, when he was asked, why do you keep practicing at the age of, I think, 90 or something like that? And he says, it's because I'm making progress, I think. So,
yeah. I agree. I mean, you know,
we should never really feel like we've arrived, right? Because that's, you know, that you might as well be dead.
Yeah. I mean, what's funny is like that, doing these interviews is kind of bizarre for me, because the way when, and I notice it when I'm talking to people, when I'm interviewing them, that I'm always so impressed with them. And then they, you know, they'll answer the questions how they do. But when I'm on the other end and people say nice things to me, I'm always like, really? I'm like, I don't know, man. I've got a lot to learn. And I feel like most people do feel like that. Like, I don't think you feel like you're, you know, you've arrived. I mean, you might be proud of things you've done and you're proud of the progress you've made, but I mean, do you feel like you've, does anybody really feel like they've done it all? Like there's always going to be more to learn. I feel like the more I learn and the more experiences I have that are, you know, the better experiences, the more I realize I need to learn even more and get even better. I mean, it doesn't seem like a cap. It seems like it's more like you get to this next plateau and you look around, you're like, wow, I didn't even see those peaks over there. Those guys are climbing those peaks. Like, let's go try to learn how to do that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You've worked with some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry. So, you know, Sopranos, obviously James Gandolfini and your current show, you're working with, Billy Bob Thornton and William Hurt and so on. And would you say that people at those types of levels have the same mindset, mentality? Have you picked up anything from working with some of those types?
I feel like I feel like all of the greats are great because they are digging. Mm. They're not fully satisfied with, you know, they're not just like checked out and doing it. Or if they are, maybe that project is not for them and they're not, you know what I mean? But I think that what I've found is like, you know, those greats, they're great for a reason. You know, they're great because they are digging and searching and reaching and you know, sometimes tragically so, where there are tons of demons and it ends up like affecting the person's health or their life. I have a tremendous amount of respect for you know, what it takes to, you know, like I said, I've been fortunate, but I don't have the kind of career at this point, nor, you know, I don't have a crystal ball to know where it will go, but like a James Gandolfini, where not only, I mean, he's doing incredible work on The Sopranos, but then also just so many people know him, and it must be oppressive to be that famous and that well known for something that it's that's a whole other aspect of my business, you know, that's scary to think about. You know, I mean, I don't have that. Maybe I have it like in some tiny little way in my own little, you know, there are some random ways where people can notice you, but
yeah. And I suppose there's, you can get too big too fast, but I, you know, it sounds to me like you're so grounded that I'm not, you know, I wouldn't put that at a high probability, but you never know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, people say that it's not, and I have, you know, friends that have kind of crossed that threshold, and they say it's not always the person themselves that changes, but the people around them that changes,
right,
and how
right.
they're treated, and it's, and that ends up being disconcerting. And you know, that's one of the things where in the last couple of years I've been kind of consciously grateful for how slow it's been. To me, it feels like right. it feels like it's been like a drip by drip kind of, like, you know, clawing up the ladder rung by rung in a way. I have not been in jeopardy of that. I feel like it's been pretty gradual, and sometimes the victories have been followed by defeats, and so you kind of have these peaks and valleys, you know.
But you've got the right mindset. I mean, really inspiring to hear you talk. So, you know, whatever happens, I'm sure you'll be in a great place. I did want to get close to wrapping things up because I do want to be respectful of your time, but you've got the second season of Goliath coming up, and you're developing projects. You're developing a project about Matt Long, who was
that's been on the back burner, and that's something that is on the back burner right now, but that I had him as a guest on the podcast. Incredible story that I, you know, want to make as a film, but I have something else that I'm working on that's smaller than that, because I feel like it's a bigger story, and it deserves more. I don't know that I'm quite ready to tell it right now the way I want to, but he's got an incredible story. It's been documented all over where he was basically, you know, you talk about 10,000 no's, he's the poster child. He was, I won't go into the whole thing, but long story short, bar owner in New York, he was a firefighter in New York, triathlete after 9/11, became a triathlete and ended up doing Ironman. He became an Ironman triathlete, and he was training for, he had just run the New York City Marathon in 2005. He qualified for Boston. He was the number four firefighter in New York for them. And a month later, after the New York City Marathon, there was a transit strike in New York City, and the city was basically shut down because there were no subways, and you couldn't drive below 96th Street. And a bus that was chartered to pick up employees that were working on Wall Street was going up 3rd Avenue, and Matt was riding up 3rd Avenue on his bike at 6 in the morning, and the driver had never driven in Manhattan, and he took a turn across 3 lanes on 3rd Avenue and just ran over Matt, and his bike, the seat post went through him, literally came out his abdomen. His pelvis was crushed. He was bleeding out on the street. They had to cut him from the bus. He was given a 5% chance to live, went to New York Presbyterian Hospital, 69 units of blood, countless surgeries. I saw him. I was out in LA. I was supposed to be with him the night before it happened, actually, in New York, and I wasn't. But I saw him 5 months later, and he went from being like, you know, Mr. Clean, like bald head and jacked, to looking like a 90-year-old man, just totally lights out, lost all this weight, was in a wheelchair, had a colostomy bag for 2 years, learned how to walk again, learned how to run again, ran the 2008 New York City Marathon, and did the 2008 Lake Placid Ironman. Jeez. Became an Ironman again, met his wife, has kids now. It's an incredible story, and he was a character before that all happened to him. I mean, he's a very funny dude, but it's an incredible story that I want to tell at some point. And
looking forward to that. Yeah, it sounds like an incredible story. And I'll also put the link. I'll certainly put the links in the show notes to your podcast, but also that particular episode.
That
sounds great. What other things have you got on the burner that my audience might be interested in?
Right now, I'd say the primary one is June 15th, which is only, you know, what is that? A couple weeks from now.
Yeah, less than just a couple. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like a week and a half or something is this season 2 of Goliath. And I'm really proud of it. I love the show. I love the vibe of the show. My character was, you know, interesting and dark, and that would be the main one I would say to look out for. That's coming right out. And actually I have a great episode this week on 10,000 No's is with the showrunner of Goliath, Lawrence Trilling, which I mentioned. And he's a great guy, and if people are already fans of the show, I would, you know, suggest listening to that.
So awesome. Yeah. I'll put all those links as well. And, you know, I urge people to check that out. We've covered a lot of ground, but I feel like I can talk, you know, for another couple of hours with you. But I do want to be respectful of your time. Was there anything that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to mention?
No, I feel like we covered a lot of ground, and I'm very impressed with what you're doing, and I hope
really
I'm contributing in some way to your listeners and what they want to hear. you know, it sounds like you've had some pretty cool guests. So it's humbling to sometimes go like, all right, people going to take this story, you know, compared to the person who, you know, whatever harrowing story they went through. So
no, this is great. I really appreciate you coming on. I think my listeners are going to very much enjoy and appreciate this. So, and every conversation is different. I kind of liken a long form conversation to a little bit of a work of art that everyone takes away something slightly different. You're never quite sure, but it's just really good to get them out there and make them, you know, real and authentic.
Agreed. Totally agree. Yeah.
So I think go for it. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I'm hoping people walk away with something. And
thank you
so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
No, thanks, Matt. Let's very much stay in touch, and we will. This was great. Very much appreciate what you've shared today, and I wish you all the best. And I know that people should, you know, get you on their radars so that they follow what you're doing, because I think you're doing some great stuff. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate it.
All right,
man.
Bye for now. So, what did you think of that? And what is your yes? And how are you going to work through those 10,000 no's? I would really like to hear from you. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to drop me a note. You can send a comment or drop a comment in the comment section at allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. And what do I think? I think you really need to check out Matthew's podcast, 10,000 No's, and that you should also check out his series, Goliath, the second season of which is out now. It's an incredible series that has received some great reviews. Links are in the show notes as usual. And I also think you should subscribe to the All Things Risk podcast if you've not yet done so. Once again, allthingsrisk.co.uk has all of the platforms in which you can subscribe. And as always, we love any positive ratings or reviews. Give us one, or simply share the show with someone who would appreciate it. That's it for now. We will be back soon in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.